When I think of the book of Nehemiah, I can remember when we used to have children's meetings over at our chapel a number of years ago. You know, I'm talking about probably, would it be 35 years ago or 30 years ago. We did a series on Nehemiah with we used to use the flannel graph in those days. And I can remember, I think I had done something like 5 or 6 lessons on Nehemiah. And I came again for the next lesson. One of the little kids up front, he says, "Oh, no, not Nehemiah again." You know, about out of it with Nehemiah at that point. I hope it doesn't affect you that way today, because it really is a fantastically interesting book. I think a challenging book, and I at least it's been to me, and I hope you find it. Oops, I better push the start here. Hope you find it that way yourself. So let's go to the first chapter. I'm going to give you a little introduction as we go along here, rather than do it all at one time. Introductions get kind of boring. So rather than do it all at one time, I'm going to kind of do it in steps to give you the background on the book of Nehemiah. But what you're going to notice as we read the first chapter, we're going to read the first chapter together. One of the first things that strikes you about, I think, about the book of Nehemiah is much of it is autobiographical. And that's unusual for a book of the Bible. You know, you stop and think about it. How many books of the Bible are autobiographical? Not too many. And quite a number of the chapters, the author is sort of giving to us details about his own experiences and his own life. Certainly not in a bragging sort of way. We know under the Holy Spirit, he wouldn't write that way. In fact, quite the opposite. The man's under very, very heavy burden throughout the whole book. So it's done in a very humble way because of what he's going through. But it is, much of the book is autobiographical, much, particularly the first 7 chapters. You will notice a lot of I's as we go through the first 7 chapters. Exception to that is the 3rd chapter, and we'll tell you why there's no I's in that chapter in a little bit. Then there's a little gap where the author seems to kind of fade out. And there's a reason for that. And then the last chapter, again, becomes very autobiographical. And there's a real reason for that, because he has got some real major problems to deal with in the very last chapter. So as we read the first chapter, you'll notice this. Now, I do want to throw out this one challenge as we read the first chapter. Did you ever think, supposing you wrote an autobiography. Ever think about this? Supposing you just sat down and kind of wrote a story of your own life. What would be the major portions in it? That is, what is the major thrust of your life as you write about it? My daughter had the experience. She was visiting a lady at the county home back in our county, and just weeks before she died, she started to dictate to my daughter about her life. She wanted her to write it down so that at her funeral and memorial service, we could print up a copy and pass it out. And we did this, and it was very challenging to some people to realize she had had a real, real hard life in her childhood. Now, when I think of my own life, you know, what would be the major thrust? We're going to discover with Nehemiah, the major thrust of his life was the work of the Lord. That's what he had to write about. His life was given over to building a wall to protect the people of God. That was really his mission. And he never questioned that mission. He didn't try to hide or run away from it like God, you know, some of God's servants, God had to deal with them. They were humble to the point that they didn't want to do the job. You know, so I'm not me. I don't want to do this job. Nehemiah didn't, we don't find this with Nehemiah. He's willing to do the job the Lord gave him, and it becomes his whole life. He pours his whole life into this. And, I think if I were to write an autobiography, could I say that my life has been poured into building for God's people? Or did I spend a lot of time tearing down? Did I spend a lot of time building my own house instead of building for the Lord? You know, and how much of my time has been selfishly spent instead of being spent for the Lord's people. And that's what we'll notice about Nehemiah. You know, it's an inspiring book because he was a very unselfish man. And this is one of the things will stand out as we read the book. He was a man who was willing to give himself to the work of the Lord and pour himself into it. All right, chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. It came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. They said to me, now notice first of all his concern. He wanted to know what happened to the people who went back. Then they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. You know, he's basically saying, you asked Nehemiah, I'm telling you, they're in big trouble down there in Jerusalem. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down and its gates are burned with fire. Now, what would be the normal reaction at this point? Probably something like this. We'd say, well, it's too bad. I'll pray for him. I'll try to remember him every day in my prayers. But notice Nehemiah's reaction. So it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Now, we discover something right away, don't we? Here's a man who God really burdened. Here's a man who took the Lord's people to heart. You know, this was not just some passing thing to him. This was not just something he was going to kind of shrug off with the words, well, I'll pray for you. This was something he really took to heart and was really burdened down. Verse 5. I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel. Your servants, before the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you, and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest part of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling place for my name. Now, these are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I pray, please, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name, and let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. Now, let's just take a minute before we look at just a couple of things here in this chapter one, in our background. Where are we as far as, the setting goes that Nehemiah finds himself in at this time? He was actually in a very dark, discouraging, almost despairing time in the history of Israel. The nation of Israel had sinned. And in 587, Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, these dates may vary a year or two or three in your chronologies. They haven't pinpointed these dates exactly. So, this just gives us a rough idea of the chronology. But Nebuchadnezzar's army came in, the Babylonians came in, burnt the temple, destroyed it, absolutely destroyed it, as was forecast, and took away the treasures in the temple. The city of Jerusalem itself was destroyed. The people were carried out in captivity. It was just an awful time, really, to be living. The final judgment that God had warned the people of Judah over and over and over again. He sent revivals. He sent kings like Josiah and Hezekiah to revive the people. They just turned away after the kings died. And finally the judgment came. It was a dark age in which to live. And Nehemiah, along with others, was taken captive. Now, one would think at this point that this was the end for Israel. That's it. They sinned. They failed. God tried to prosper them as a nation. He tried to use them, tried to bless them. They turned their backs on God. They turned to idols. It was over. But one of the things that strikes us about the book of Nehemiah is, first of all, one of the things that, if you were to sit down and read all 13 chapters, one of the things that would strike you is the sovereignty of God. That just stands out. It just, just comes right out of this book. And we see this displayed when God deals with Israel and the nations, don't we? God has a purpose, and that purpose will be fulfilled despite the unfaithfulness of his people. He's going to carry it out. He's got a plan. He's got a purpose. So did God give up on Israel? Has God laid Israel aside forever? No way. No way. He had made a covenant. He had made a promise to Abram. And no matter what went wrong or appeared to go wrong, God was going to see that promise fulfilled. So in a sense, Nehemiah was living in very dark days, but as we noticed in this first chapter, he never gave up on the fact that God would not give up on Israel. God had his purposes, and God, he knew, had a way of accomplishing what he said he would accomplish. We live in similar days, don't we? That's why the book of Nehemiah, to me, proved to be very inspiring and helpful, and encouraging and strengthening to study. We know that the church has declined. There's been departure. There's a falling away taking place such as we have never seen before. But remember, God's sovereign. God has his purposes. His church is not going to fail. The Lord Jesus said, I will build my church. And nothing's going to keep him from that purpose. Even though things at times may look absolutely hopeless, absolutely despairing. So we rest not only on the sovereignty of God as it's displayed in these books, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. We see how God, just amazingly, in these what we call the post-captivity books, after Israel was taken captive. We see God doing amazing things through sovereigns, through kings, through leaders, you know. We see God doing miraculous things that his people might survive, that there might always be a remnant. And we also then, in addition to the sovereignty of God, we sense in this book the determination of faith, don't we? That is, God has always had a remnant of people who were determined to trust him and go on despite the despair and darkness around them. And in a sense, then, we can say Nehemiah lived in very discouraging, dark days, and yet, by the same token, we can say he lived in very exciting days. Because he was seeing God perform almost overwhelming miracles to get his people back to Jerusalem and keep them there, to rebuild a temple, to put walls around that city, and to actually bring that city that had been destroyed back into being again with the house of God there. And he was living in those days. See? So there were days, in a sense, despairing because his nation was in captivity, and yet there were days for faith of great excitement because he saw God working in a most miraculous way. And that's why I think the book of Nehemiah is most encouraging. Zerubbabel goes to Jerusalem in 538. Just to give you a picture of the setting here, Zerubbabel, of course you know, is the man who went back and God used him with the people that were with him to build the temple, to rebuild, to put a new temple there. A miracle that one would never have imagined could happen. And that's in the first half of the book of Ezra. The temple was completed about 517. That date varies some depending whose chronologies you're reading, but it was roughly that, 70 years after the fall of Jerusalem, which was exactly what Daniel had prophesied. And then 458, Ezra goes to Jerusalem. Remember, Ezra goes as a priest. He is a priest. He goes when the temple's completed, and it is his purpose to teach the people in the law, that is, in the books of the Pentateuch, to build them up again, to establish their faith. And he goes back to Jerusalem 80 years later. And then Nehemiah goes to Jerusalem 13 years later because he is being used of God to rebuild the walls. That gives you kind of the picture. So that the book of Nehemiah concludes around 433, which would be 105 years after Zerubbabel had gone to Jerusalem. So we have about a century, actually. When you go from Ezra, through Ezra to Nehemiah, you have a whole century going by. So you wouldn't realize that as you sit and read the book. You wouldn't sense that many years have gone by. But we have to remember, we're dealing with a long period of time here, when you consider our country is only a little over 200 years old. We're talking about almost half the history of our own country transpires here in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, notice when Nehemiah receives the news that the people are in despair in Jerusalem, even though the temple's been rebuilt. The walls aren't there. They're open to their enemies. Things are not going well. You'll notice that he immediately goes into fasting and praying. His heart is broken, as we were saying earlier. He's really exercised about this. He's deeply concerned. And he then prays. And it's so beautiful to read this initial prayer of Nehemiah's. You'll notice that first of all, the first thing we note about the prayer is it's a prayer of contrition. he is, it's a prayer of, you know, sorrow over his people's sins. And truly, if we're going to take the part of the people of God, in other words, if we're going to be able to write an autobiography of a life that's given over to helping the people of God, the first thing that has to happen in our life is that we have to be identified with their problems and their sorrow. We've got to become one of them. We're a part of them. Nehemiah didn't blame others. He didn't try to defend Israel. You know, he didn't try to say, Lord, this shouldn't be happening to them. Why are you doing this? No. He immediately confesses. You notice in verse 6, he says, confess the sins of the children of Israel, which, and it's interesting, the pronoun here, confess the sins of the children of Israel, which they have sinned against you. No, which we have sinned against you. He identifies himself with them. He says, both my father's house and I have sinned. Now, it's an amazing thing then that this is true of almost without exception. Any person that God has used, any vessel that God has used to deliver his people, to help his people, he first of all, God has had to bring that vessel. He's had to break it, in other words. He's had to bring it to a point of contrition. As long as we have the attitude, well, you know, these poor people, they really need help. And I'm the one can help them, you know, and because I'm so much better than they, and I can get things straightened out, and I'm going to go in there, and I'm going to get things straightened out. No, when we have that attitude, everything is just going to blow apart. But his attitude was, you know, God, we're in a desperate strait. And I'm just as guilty of this as anybody else. The reason we're in this mess, I'm just as much to blame as anybody else. And God, I'm asking you to help us in our desperate strait. Now notice how he gets the confidence to ask God for help. That's the next thing. What is faith built on? You know, if this was a man of determined faith, if he was willing to come to God when others were departing, if he was willing to seek God's help while others were running away from God, what is the secret? What is faith based on? You'll notice he says in verse 8, remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, and then he goes on and he quotes Moses, and he reminds God that he had promised, yes, he would scatter them among the nations. And that's what happened to them. They had disobeyed, they had sinned, and Nehemiah owns that. We deserve. He said, we've got what we deserve. But he reminds God, but he says, you know, God, yes, you said you would scatter us, but you know you also promised that if we return, notice verse 9, if we return, you would bring them to the place which you've chosen to put your name there. And Nehemiah is basically saying, God, you promised if we would return, you'd forgive us. And I'm laying my hands on that. I believe that by faith. I'm laying claim to that. That's what faith does. In other words, faith doesn't... Here's an important point that I want to stress. Faith, yes, we are led to recognize our failure, our sin, and we confess it, and we should mourn before God. But we don't then spend the rest of our life mourning about our weaknesses, our sin and our failure. And too often, this is what often happens. I mean, first of all, I guess we should say the first thing, we have to be awakened. Too often the people of God, you know, are in trouble, and they won't even recognize it. They're just, you know, like the Jews who were in the dispersion, and we're just living it up, and we're not concerned about our failure. But then the problem is when God makes us concerned and makes us realize our failure, too often then we dwell on our sin and on our failure. No, God doesn't want that either. He wants, after we recognize our sin and failure, to move on. And that's exactly what Nehemiah does here. He says, yes, your word has told us why we're being punished. We know why we are. But your word also promises deliverance. And God, I'm laying hold of this. I want you to deliver us. And this is the action of faith. They also notice this action of faith in verse 10. And here's real intercession. He says, now, these are your servants, your people, whom you redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. In other words, he's laying claim also to the fact that these people were God's people. And he knew that God would never desert his people. And he was laying hold of this. In other words, he was linking the necessity for God to answer his prayer with the character of God. He was in effect saying, God, if you are who you say you are, then you must do something about this. You can't desert us because of who you are, because of your promises. And this is basically the start of Nehemiah's being used of God. He laid hold of the promises of the person of God and trusted him to get them out of the dilemma they were in. And that's always the way faith acts. We get ourselves in terrible dilemmas sometimes, don't we? Through our own sin, our own failure, our own stupidity, our own rebellion, stiffness and hardness. We get ourselves in big problems. We've all experienced it. But then faith, when it reaches the point where we realize the direction we've taken and how wrong it is, faith reaches out and gets hold of God and looks to God for deliverance. It doesn't just stay in a state of mourning, but it reaches out. And you'll notice just one more unique thing before we take a look at chapter 2. Do you notice the last verse here? He's asking God, basically, to use him. That's basically what he's saying. He says, I want you to listen to the prayer of your servant, to the prayer of your servants, and let your servant prosper this day. Now, what he means by that is, he wasn't asking for material prosperity. What he meant by that is, I have a desire to help these people. You prosper this desire. You help me to put it into effect. In other words, it's not enough for us to intercede on behalf of the people of God, but we have to be willing to let God use us then in delivering the people of God. And that's what Nehemiah was basically doing here. He was basically saying to God, God, if you can use me, if you can, well, he's not even saying if. He says, I want you to use me. I want you to use me to get the people out of this predicament. And he says, I pray, granting mercy, meaning himself, granting mercy, notice this phrase, in the sight of this man. You know who he was talking to when he said in the sight of this man? He was talking about the king of Persia, one of the greatest monarchs that ever sat on a throne, and he's calling him this man. You know why he was? Because he was before God. And that's all that king was, just a man. He was nothing more. I mean, he may have had a crown sitting on his head, and he may have had a scepter in his hand, and he may have had power to do a lot of things, but he had nothing over God. He was just a man. Nehemiah was not going to fear man when he came into the presence of God. And it's interesting that when we look at history, we see that God used Babylon to crush Judah, to punish them. He used them to take them into captivity. But it's amazing how then God used the kings of Persia, as we come into Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther, how he used the kings of Persia to bring about a return of his people, to do amazing answers of prayer at kings that didn't even know most of the time what they were doing, but yet they granted permission for various things that one never would have thought would have been possible. And God, as it were, just kind of turned around history at this particular point. It's an exciting point in the history of Israel for those who were of the faithful remnant. But let us remember, as we go into chapter 2, I'm not going to read chapter 2, I'm just going to point out a couple things in it. But as we go into chapter 2, let's remember this. The majority of Israel was in dispersion, in captivity. This was just a handful. We'll say more about that in our next lesson when we look at chapter 3. This was just a remnant that returned. Now, in verses 1 to 8 of chapter 2, he's making a request of the king. He's coming before this great king, Artaxerxes, a mighty man whom history talks about. He was a powerful king, one in whose presence a cupbearer would have good reason to tremble. I don't know, whether all these stories are true. We have no way of really knowing. The Bible doesn't tell us this, but apparently a cupbearer occupied a very important position. He was responsible for maintaining the health and the care of the king. So some tell us that he actually had to pre-taste the food and pre-drink the wine before the king did to make sure it wasn't poison, because they used to love to poison their officials in those days. That was their way of eliminating them. Not too different today. We use a few little different tactics, but we have much the same ways of handling things. And he had a very responsible position. But they tell us that it was extremely important in this position to always maintain a cheerful attitude when you went into the presence of the king. You know, obviously, you didn't go in the presence of a great monarch looking like you hated the job, and you were grumbling, and it was a lousy day, and no. I mean, you had to, the idea was you were to go into the presence of the monarch no matter what was happening back home. I mean, your wife may have just beaten you and may have thrown the kids out of the house and refused to make your meals, and I mean, it may have just been a horrible day, but before you went into the presence of the king, you spruced yourself up and you got your million-dollar smile and you went in there to present. He goes into the presence of the king, and the king notices he's sick at heart. He's got a burden. There's something wrong. And when the king asks him the question, verse 2, why is your face sad since you're not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. And now we understand. He says, then I became dreadfully afraid. We understand this. He had good reason to be dreadfully afraid. If things had taken their normal procedure without the intervention of God, the next step would have been, the king would have called one of his servants and said, get this man out of my presence. I don't want him back here. I don't want a man coming in here with a sad heart. But it's not the way the king reacted. Now, the beautiful thing is, before he made his request of the king, before he came into the presence of the king, he was in the presence of God, wasn't he? Chapter 1, we're in the presence of God. Chapter 2, we're in the presence of the king. What a difference it makes. If only you and I would learn the secret of this lesson, that before we proceed with anything in relation to the work of God, we need, first of all, to be in the presence of God and to be requesting Him before we take any steps. That's why, for example, in an assembly, corporate prayer is so vital. I don't know what happens in your assembly, but we get a very poor attendance at our corporate prayer meetings. And rightly so, a brother just approached me last week. He was distressed over the fact that we had such poor attendance at our prayer meetings. He said, can't we do something about this? It's a proper burden. He's right about his distress. Because really, we can't proceed. We cannot do anything in the presence of man unless we, first of all, have been in the presence of God. And corporate prayer is so vital to an assembly and then so vital in my individual life. And of course, maybe the reason corporate prayer has lost its meaning is because it's lost its meaning in our private life. You know, usually the two go together. If I'm not attending the assembly prayer meeting, it's usually a sign I'm not doing much in prayer in my own life. Because the two usually go together. If I'm exercised about prayer, it's going to carry over into the assembly. Well, Nehemiah then comes before the king, and we know the story. The king, amazingly, gives him permission to take a remnant back to Jerusalem and rebuild that wall. Something that I'm sure in his, what shall we say, in his fantasy, Nehemiah could never have imagined would have occurred. That the king, the great king of Persia, would actually give him permission to go back there. Not only give him permission, but give him protection and give him supplies and, you know, give him all he needed to go back there and build that wall. And raise up the people to go with him. In verses 9 to 16, he goes to Jerusalem and he inspects the walls. He sees for himself that the report that he got, you know, when he was back in the king's palace was not a false report. Things were as bad as they said they were. So it was important, of course, to check that out. Sometimes people will come and tell you things about the work of the Lord that is distorted, not exactly the way they told you. I'm sure you've experienced that. So it's good to check things out. But he checked it out, and there was one thing he discovered very quickly, that if he was going to rebuild those walls, he was going to have some people that were opposed to it. Verse 10, he is introduced to Sanballat and Tobiah. And these names are going to appear throughout the book. Wherever God is doing a work, there are enemies. Ever, ever, ever. We must face this fact. We must make up our mind to it. There will always be opposition to anything that God asks me to do for Him. Man, that's been a lesson that's been so hard for me to learn. You know, I still struggle with that. It is just, I'm saying still because I'm pretty old now. But I'm still struggling with it. You know, I always think, you know, if God has asked you to do something, then everything should fall in place, and certainly not, no one, you know, that professes to be a Christian should be opposed to what you're doing. And then when you get opposition, particularly from those who profess to be the people of God. And by the way, Sanballat and Tobiah, you see, were dwellers in the land. They were not enemies from afar. They were dwellers in the land, you see. They were part of what we'd say the profession. And that always shakes you up, doesn't it? Opposition just does something to you. It's hard for us to take. But if we're going to serve God, we must accept the fact. We must absolutely accept the fact that we're going to get opposition. And we must not let this opposition get us down. And we're going to see how this appears throughout the book. As he closes in verses 17 to 20, what stands out here is there is resolve on the part of Nehemiah. There is ridicule on the part of his enemies. And they're two good R's to take with you in the work of the Lord. You need resolve on your part. You've got to expect ridicule on your part. You're going to experience both. One of the reasons why I'm convinced we're not getting things done in this day and age, why the work of the Lord is lagging, why it's slowed up, why the building is not taking place, is we lack resolve, first of all. If I can just be perfectly blunt with those of you that are younger, and I'm not in saying this, I'm not trying to point fingers, I'm not trying to excuse myself, I'm not trying to slip out. But one of the things that young Christians need to learn in this country is to have more stick-to-itiveness, resolve, determination. We quit too easily. And I've experienced this over and over again. Assignments that were given to young men to carry out that never get carried out. Because they lack the resolve. They're in the work of the Lord. And this is something you need to come before the Lord and ask Him to give you that resolve. Notice in verse 18, here we see the resolve. I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Didn't we just have a conference recently called Rise Up and Build? Yeah, we did. You know where the words come from. Tremendous words. Tremendous exhortation. Let's rise up and build. We need to be reminded of this over and over again. This resolve is so needed in the day and age in which we live. But then you'll notice in the very next verse, that was verse 18. One verse later, here's Sanballat and Tobiah, and a third one, Geshem. And what are they doing? Are they saying, yes, rise up and build. Go ahead, fellas. We're behind you. Go at it. This, of course, is what we like in the work of the Lord, and we need encouragement. But we must remember that many times the Lord calls us to do things that aren't going to be popular with perhaps a large number of even the Lord's people. We have to remember this. We can't, in other words, be doing things that people always like. And that's one of our problems. You know, we just kind of have built within us, we want to please people. And after all, isn't that a Christian thing, to please people? Sure it is. Christians to be pleasing. We're not to be ornery. We're not to be... But sometimes that very desire can interfere from us carrying out the work of the Lord in that we're afraid to move ahead because some people aren't approving. We can't withstand the ridicule. And these men... They're saying, what is this thing you're doing? They say here in verse 19. What are you doing? Are you going to rebel against the king? they're trying to accuse them, you know, of doing something that's not right. You know, they're basically saying, you can't do this. You're dishonoring the king in doing this. And notice Nehemiah's answer. We'll close our session with this, our first session. I answered them and said to them, and this answer of Nehemiah, you know, shows you the way God prepared this man's heart, what kind of a heart he had. He said, the God of heaven will prosper us. He doesn't say maybe the God of heaven might prosper us. He says, the God of heaven will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. And so he makes a clear distinction between those who were sincerely the people of God and wanted to serve him, and those who were the ridiculers, the